So one of the things I do is I write advance obituaries for the New York Times. And
really?
And so I
advance obituaries?
Right.
Like, wow. That's kind of dark.
Like, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah, right.
I'm feeling better now. And so I pitched because I love that book so much, Golf in the Kingdom, Mike Murphy. And so Mike and I started having these lunches in Mill Valley, which is where he lives. And I mean, I know.
Wait a second. Did you call up Michael Murphy and say, hey, I just got assigned to write your obituary. Can we hang out?
I said,
how did that go?
No, I said I just pitched it to my editor.
You pitch obituaries? Dude, I'm missing out on so many opportunities. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. I'm your host, the senior editor at the Golfers Journal as well, and lover of all things Titleist. So just some quick Titleist news off the top. Personal news, really. As we know, the new generation of Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X feature longer distance, softer feel, and increased control. Now, I had a pretty good golf weekend, Friday and Saturday. Played somewhere pretty special. I don't want to name drop. Okay, I played Oakmont. A very challenging track, as we would all imagine. And on Friday, not my career round, but on Saturday, someone put into my hand the Titleist Pro V1 left dot. Now, I'd heard about the left dot and the left dash and just thought, well, that might be just sort of more than I need. Love my Pro V1. And, you know, I just don't want to get too technical with it. But they explained it to me, what left actually means in the Titleist lexicon. Whether it be left dot or left dash, the dot is Pro V1, the dash is Pro V1X. Left is for less. So less spin on longer clubs and less height. So a little bit lower. Now, when I heard that, I thought, well, this might be the way to go. And it turns out, as someone who hits the ball a little, maybe sometimes too high, and can get a little spinny with the longer clubs, it was just what the doctor ordered. Saturday was at least 10 shots better on those insane Oakmont greens, and just felt like I definitely picked up about a half, pretty much a half club, just in terms of a better trajectory. I was carrying stuff on Saturday that I wasn't on Friday. So if you want to check it out, go to Titleist.com. Lots of different sort of variations of the Pro V1 and Pro V1X you can get, from sort of color to the left dot and the left dash. And don't forget about our friend, the AVX, as well. So get yourself tuned into the right ball, and as Titleist says, always bring your best. Someone who's bringing their best in Golfers Journal 17, a segue of sorts. Hope you're enjoying 17, everybody. It is, as always, jam-packed and jelly tight with great stuff. My favorite piece, I'm just going to put it out there, Katie Hafner's Women of a Certain Era. Hopefully you're enjoying that story as well. And what I love about it, there's a lot of different things to love about it. Primary among them, though, is that Katie, she's written everywhere, but hasn't written or published on golf before. So I believe it's her first time writing about golf, and she does such an extraordinary job with it, which I just think is so cool. And the way that she, because really, as with all good golf stories, it's not primarily just about golf. It's about people and her personal journey as well. Discovering Marion Hollins by playing Marion Hollins is Pasatiempo. Now, if you don't know who Marion Hollins is, great player, really important developer of golf courses back in the golden age, responsible for some of our finest courses, particularly in and around Monterey. But along with getting that history, we get all this other stuff, you know, from Katie and how she's come to golf recently and her new passion for it, playing with strangers, getting made up with strangers at Pasatiempo. I feel like the conversation we're about to have is much the same. I think we get into some history, but we get into a lot of other things as well that I think you're going to enjoy. Most importantly, the glory of the Olympic burger dog. We talk about dating via spreadsheet, which is pretty interesting, I thought. And my favorite part of the conversation is, well, at least as a writer, all the different writing gigs that one can have, including writing obituaries for living people. So all of you Michael Murphy fans, I think that's actually Katie's first golf writing, is writing Michael Murphy's obituary, author of Golf in the Kingdom, who is still very much alive. So that's a story to stick around for. But I think the best part of the interview is we get to experience Katie's conversion from someone who abhorred golf, had no time for it at all, and now is as passionate about the game as anyone. She would have formerly been someone who wouldn't probably have been caught dead reading something called The Golfer's Journal, and now she's writing for it. So if you know someone like that who you might bring over to The Golfer's Journal, convert them to the game, or someone who's already diehard and passionate about it, doesn't matter. If you want to share The Golfer's Journal with them, good news, the referral game is back. It is back on for October, and we're giving away the greatest thing we can give away. Well, aside from our love. But it's our love packaged in the form of a Scotty Cameron Golfer's Journal limited edition putter. They're back. They're beautiful. And the game just couldn't be easier. You go on to golfersjournal.com. You log into your account. There's your member locker. You get your little referral code. You throw that into texts. You throw that into email. You throw it on Twitter. You throw it anywhere. Anyone that clicks on it and signs up, you start winning stuff. Like, stuff just starts showing up at your house. I did it. I probably wasn't supposed to do it, but I do it as well. It's just not because I want more, you know, Golfer's Journal stuff. That I can usually get that. It's just so easy, and it's kind of fun to see your name on the leaderboard. So get back in the game. October referrals, subscription referrals. Get that Scotty Cameron putter. Make it happen. You win one, and the person you referred wins one as well. Two Scotties. How good is that? And you'll be giving them stories from writers like Katie Hafner. So let's get to my conversation with Katie. This is our first time speaking, but I think you'll find, I think we have a pretty good rapport. She's a really special person. It was like talking to an old friend. And it turns out, really one of the favorite people that I've spoken with on the podcast, because in getting to experience and listen to her discover her passion and her love for golf, as someone who's played for a few years now, I could feel myself rediscovering and rekindling my own.
So, but can I interview you just for a sec to ask you how you came up with the Burger Dog Index?
So I was trying to come up with a different way to rate the courses. I originally just put, and in the past books, Ireland and Scotland, where I've done similar things, I didn't actually have a rating scale for the courses. But I figured this is an American golf course book, and we rate our courses and rank them and all that, whether for better or for worse. And it just makes for conversation. So I said, all right, let me put in some sort of star rating system. But stars seemed lame and overdone. Golf balls seemed stupid. I had to give it some, there had to be something. And I thought, all right, Burger Dogs I get so excited about the Burger Dog, the idea of the Burger Dog. In fact, I was just at Kinloch. Shout out to Kevin Collins, who my host there as a kid once ate 37 Burger Dogs in one month and got in trouble when the bill came. That's a different podcast.
It's like $11 now, right? Or something like that. Wait, can we just...
You can't put a price on it, Katie.
I know they are like the MasterCard thing, just priceless. But do you think that listeners know enough about Burger Dogs that we can just talk about them without describing them?
You're better at this than I am. We should describe the Burger Dog. How would you describe the Burger Dog, being a West Coaster?
Well, so my husband, who's been infatuated with Burger Dogs for many, many, many decades.
Your husband's awesome. He has my book, right? He loves Burger Dogs.
He lives. He arranges his entire day of golf around the Burger Dog, like when he's going to get to the shack. Okay, so the Burger Dog is a phenomenon. Wouldn't you call it a phenomenon?
Yes.
Not just a food, a phenomenon.
Absolutely.
Of the Olympic Club. Which is near my house in San Francisco. And my husband was telling me about these things called Burger Dogs, and I actually couldn't picture it.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, is it? He said, well, it's a hamburger, but it's shaped like a hot dog, but not really, because it's kind of flat. And it's in a hot dog bun, but I said, that sounds gross. Right. And then he said, no, you've got to try it, because the bun is like grilled, and then there's this American cheese that oozes. And I thought, oh, this sounds even worse. And we get there, and the first thing we have to do is make a, I'd never even been to the Olympic Club. Before I met him, I had never stepped foot on a golf course. I just thought they were just, oh, the game was odious. I thought the people who played it were horrible. And then I met him, and I realized if I'm going to spend time with this guy, he's like a two-trick pony. He's a physician. He does that, and he has golf. And I thought, well, I can't practice medicine, so I will learn to play golf, which is, it's been quite an adventure. Anyway, so I get to the Olympic Club, first time in my life, and we make a beeline for the Burger Dog Shack. So there are two places you can get the Burger Dog at the Olympic Club. One is at this shack that is near the range, and the other is when you at the turn. Right. And he gets it a certain way, and it has to be that certain way, or it's a Shonda, as he would say. Anything that isn't exactly the way he gets his Burger Dog is a Shonda. And he loves them. They are in fact a hamburger that are, they're kind of a long rectangle, right? Yeah. So they're not really round. Right. They're flat, wouldn't you say? Or flattened.
Flat-ish. Yeah. Flat-ish. They're not, it's not a round, it's not a tube. No.
No, it's not like a hot dog tube.
No, it is not.
But there's something about the ratio, as he would say, not that I've been influenced by him. Mm. Between the bun, the amount of bun and burger, that is so much better than a hamburger. And I can't, and there's something about the way your mouth fits around it that is just so much more appropriate.
Yeah. Right. Because think, you go into the burger, it's not mouth size. You know, you're more than half of it is going to end up on your cheeks. So you go in the Burger Dog, that problem solved. It is seasoned one. Let's not overlook the seasoning, the grilled onions, the flavor that, you know, it sort of rises above. You know, it's got a lot of things going. You know, golf course at Olympic is nice too, but it's the it's the Burger Dogs. And we're speaking this because in the back of a course called America, I rate the courses on the Burger Dog scale, 1 to 4 Burger Dogs. And there's very few 4 Burger Dog courses. One of them being, segue, here we go. I think Pasatiempo got 4 Burger Dogs.
Should we look? Okay.
We'll just say that it did because it's a better segue to your story, which is largely about Pasatiempo, but I think most importantly and most interestingly, you know, about the woman behind it, Marion Hollins, a little bit of Glenna Collette in there in the story, Women of a Certain Era in Golfers Journal 17. It's such a fantastic story, so well researched. And I love the approach that you took in it, Katie, that, you know, it's a, so, and that's what I want to talk about today a little bit, you know, as a writer to another writer, your approach on this, on taking on golf, you know, looking at your bio, you've written everywhere, New York Times, Esquire, et cetera. Not a lot of golf in your bio, in your writing bio. Was this your first time taking on golf as a subject?
Absolutely. Well, I'm writing my essay collection.
Now you are.
Pebble and Pearl. And so I've written the Pebble and Pearl chapter, which is about my husband and I going to Pebble. And that was memorable. I parred the 5th hole, just saying.
Look at you.
I know.
Look. How long have you been playing?
About 4 years. So I'm really bad. Let's put it that way.
Wouldn't say so.
So that there's Pebble and Pearl, and then but the first essay is called Golfer Bride, about taking up the game, which we know, you know, that when it's a famous kind of adage that if, you know, the wife takes up golf, it could break up the marriage. It could, you know, friends counsel the wife against, or the husband against letting the wife do it. And my husband was, quote, deeply ambivalent, as he put it. So I've been writing a little bit, and then there's one that there's an essay I call Golf in the Kingdom, because one of the things,
kind of taken, but you roll with it, you go with it.
So one of the things I do is I write advance obituaries for the New York Times. And
really?
And so I
advance obituaries.
Right.
Like, wow. That's kind of dark.
Like, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah, right.
I'm feeling better now. And so I pitched because I love that book so much, Golf in the Kingdom, Mike Murphy. And so Mike and I started having these lunches in Mill Valley, which is where he lives. And I mean, I know.
Wait a second. Did you call up Michael Murphy and say, hey, I just got assigned to write your obituary. Can we hang out?
I said,
how did that go?
No, I said I just pitched it to my editor.
You pitch obituaries? Dude, I'm missing out so many opportunities.
It's such a pleasure because you really are you feel like you're really honoring the person in the way they deserve to be honored. I mean, I don't know what you think of that book, but I love that book and I love him.
Yeah.
And I love Esalen, the Esalen Institute that he started. So,
yes.
So it was kind of a win-win-win-win.
There's a lot. There was a lot of interesting things happened after Golf in the Kingdom that Michael Murphy's been spending his time involved in, and it's turned into things much bigger than just a mm-hmm. book. But we'll save that for another podcast. In any event, so you sat down with him, and he was cool with you writing his obituary.
He kept saying, wait till my wife hears about this. She's going to just, I forget what he said, but she was sort of a little blasé about it. And he is lovely. He is a gem. I brought many copies of Golf in the Kingdom. He'd say, where did you get this? Hmm. I'd say, well, I found it for him to sign to friends.
I stole it from the library.
I stole it. So anyway, so then somebody told me, maybe it was David Owen said, I was looking for a home for stories. And he said, ask Travis at the Golfer's Journal. And so I wrote to him, to Travis, and I said, do you have many women writing about golf, in particular, writing about women in golf? And he said, no. He said, we could use a few more of stories like that. So
yeah.
So then I just had this idea, it kind of gelled. I thought, I'm so interested in the female golfers of the early 20th century. I don't know. It's kind of a sweet spot in the history of women in golf. And then Marion Hollins, who is just so fascinating to me because I was, when I was doing Pebble and Pearl, that chapter about Pebble, I was reading about her and Pebble and Cypress and her famous shot over the chasm
on 16,
that became, is it the 16th hole at Cypress?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then I said to Travis, maybe the conceit, maybe the anchor for the story is a day spent at Pasatiempo. And he said, that sounds great. Let's do it.
So that's pretty cool to hear that you came up with that collaboratively because, I've read the story a few times. Getting into it the first time, I was like, okay, this is going to be, and when reading it before it even showed up in the magazine, said, oh, cool, we've got a history story about Marion Hollins. You brought a lot more to it than that. You did a really nice job, a wonderful job, I think, of weaving together an actual round of golf, which is fun and entertaining, with Bill and Roger. they became interesting. Wonderful how golf, can gift you these characters.
I know.
Get set up. Like, I've made a career out of that, hoping to get set up with strange people.
I was channeling my inner Tom Coyne.
Oh, don't do that.
This guy who writes these really, really funny books about golf. And I thought, what would Tom do in this situation? He would see Roger's cart hurtling over the cliff and he would make hay of that, right?
And you did. And I love that moment. So for folks that haven't had a chance to read this wonderful story in 17, and you might not know who Marion Hollins was, and I'll be honest, going into this, I didn't know who Glenna Collette was going into the story in my history research. So I think it's It's just a, we get to learn those things in the story. We get to experience Pasatiempo alongside of you. We get this wonderful perspective as a new-ish golfer into the, you know, to the game and all those sort of anxieties that you have that sometimes people, if you've been playing for 30 years, you kind of forget, like that idea of like, all right, am I standing in the right place? Am I going to get hit? You know, like if I go up to the forward tee, I love that narrative that runs like through this. I think it's like so honest and it's actually, and it's really quite funny. We should probably tell folks, all right, if you don't know who's Marion Hollins and Glenna Collette hits a 307 yards in 1920 something with a gutta perch ball and whatever kind of, you know,
what do you think insane. Her club was? What was she, what was her club made of?
I mean, it's hickory shafted with, you know, the heads or what, walnut, oak, persimmon, I guess would be the obvious one to think of, but you know, to hit a ball 307 yards, unheard of, man or woman at that time. Mm-hmm. And you know, so I love how you start the story with this conversation. Like, we don't get this sort of boring in the history of golf, there have been extraordinary achievements. No, it's we get an anecdote. You know, we're in a scene with you and your husband talking about, did you know who the greatest golfer of this era is?
And I actually recorded the conversation in case he wanted to
in case
deny
was
that
you.
He ever said it.
Wow! Again, journalist, one upping me there on with your journalistic chops. You really, wow, that's fantastic. So yeah, you can tell them you have the proof. So tell us about who these amazing women of a certain era were.
So Glenna Collette was this very, let's not forget that these women were, by and large, I would say pretty much, I'd say 99% of them came from very wealthy families. Mm-hmm. They would just, you know, a lot of them were all around sports women. Glenna Collette, Marion Hollins, they did a lot of different sports. I mean, Babe, the famous Babe Zaharias, who came slightly a bit later than they did, but she was like one of the best all around athletes in the history of athletics.
Everything.
I mean, yeah, she won a bunch of medals at the Olympics in different sports, and
right,
she picked up golf when she was in her 40s or something like
that. I know,
her 30s. But and you can see the some of these women actually in the movie Pat and Mike. The women, the Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, you can see the women because she's a golfer. Katharine Hepburn is, have you seen that?
No, I have not.
Yeah, it's great. And there's,
but I know
Babe.
She played a lot of golf. I know she grew up, if I'm not wrong, near the Fenwick golf course in Rhode Island, maybe. In any event,
anyway, so Marion, who's kind of a generation before that, grew up in this very wealthy household. Her father was, I think, on Wall Street, Mr. Hollins, and she just abandoned the East Coast for the West Coast pretty early. And she was there at the beginning of Pebble and Cyprus. And the famous Cyprus story is that she was walking the course with the then architect of Cyprus before he died. Is Rayner, is that his name?
Yeah, Seth Rayner, before, you know, everyone just immediately goes to Mackenzie.
Mm-hmm.
But first, towards the end of his life, Seth Rayner was trying to lay it out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she, this was that, now it's been luckily recorded by Mackenzie himself, mm-hmm. in his posthumously published autobiography. She and Rayner were walking the what was to be Cyprus, and he lamented that they couldn't build a hole in this one area because no one would be able to hit the ball over the ocean.
Yeah.
And she said, what do you mean no one can hit the ball over the ocean? And she picked up a club. What do you think it was, Tom? I say in the story, I hope it was a brassy, which I guess is like a two wood. Is that right?
I like brassy. Yeah, yeah, brassy. We'll go with brassy. She probably,
because
yeah,
it has a little more loft, right?
Right. I don't think she hits driver over that. I mean, or would hit drive, you know. She's just trying to see how far she can hit it, I guess. So she's not worried about the loft or the approach angle, but I don't think she needed driver there. We'll go with brassy.
So she slams the thing over.
Slams it.
Over this big chasm and proves her point. And thus was born the 16th hole at Cypress.
Everybody's favorite. One of the great holes in golf. Certainly, well, if you can get there, the most photographed par three in golf and the most famous. So one of the most famous golf holes on one of the most famous golf courses, we'll say, thanks to Marion Hollins and her being able to pound it. And, you know, and she does so much for golf between, you know, Pebble Beach. She's got like an, I always thought like, when, you know, as I was doing the research on Marion Hollins, which is not that easy to do. I was impressed by your research because it's not like, you know, there's, you know, if you want to read about Mackenzie or Charles Blair McDonald, there are books and biographies and autobiographies and books they've written. And it's just more accessible necessarily than Marion Hollins' story.
Mm-hmm.
But her story is no less, her story is frankly, it's more impressive because what she can do as a player plus what she does as like a developer, like in business, she was really sharp and accomplished. And then what she does as an architect, you know, I mean, there's really no one beside that I can think of that does all three aside from someone like Bobby Jones. I mean, it's really where her name belongs, but of course, the women not getting the spotlight as in those early days of golf as they should have, which is so great about your story. Oh, let me note, Katharine Hepburn, Fenwick, Connecticut, I believe, rather than Rhode Island. Just saying that so I don't have to go back and edit the podcast. So great player comes to Paso Tiempo though. And that's where you in the story sort of follow her footsteps and use that as a vehicle playing her Paso Tiempo golf course. That where, you know, what was the relationship with Mackenzie? Which she hires Mackenzie.
She hired Mackenzie to come. So the Olmsteads did the kind of the landscaping.
Right.
She hired Mackenzie to lay it out. And that's how that then led to her influence on Augusta. And they had, I think, a great relationship. They both built houses at Paso Tiempo. He had his ashes scattered on the golf course. And which is, I think, just wonderful. And so the locals,
cool.
And the people who, you know, play it every day, whenever they, you know, play it, they think of him. They think he's watching.
And his house is right there.
His house is right there.
You can
there.
See his house. As you were noting, Marion Hollins' house is harder to catch a glimpse of.
Yeah, I drove by it and I couldn't really figure out much about it. But I think it looked beautiful. And so they lived this I want to say just the high life there. I did a lot of reading about it. There is a biography of her. And I tried to reach the guy who wrote it. I think he has died. I couldn't reach him. But he was married, I think, to Marion Hollins' niece, if I'm not wrong. I could be wrong about that. He was married when he was alive. And so he got very interested in Aunt Marion. And that's why he wrote the book. And there's even he had trouble. There wasn't all that much left behind in terms of archival material. Amazingly, Paso Tiempo, as all great golf courses do, they have a whole history, a historian, and they have archives. And so I went with the resident historian of Paso Tiempo down into this kind of basement-y like place where you'd think there would be archives. And we were just digging through files. And And at one point she goes, oh, I think this is her will.
What?
I know, right? And I said, really? Let me see that. And it really wasn't that revealing, but it was wonderful to find it. I think it was a copy of the will.
Yeah.
But it was just lying around. And I mean, her life, so for a long time, she did live this good life. She never married. They would have like movie stars of the day come to Pasatiempo. It was, then it was, there was, I think there was a swimming pool and there were tennis courts. I think they're still there. I didn't see them though. And there's, and there was a, you know, an equestrian track, right? Or course, or what do they call it?
Steeplechase.
Yes.
Yeah.
That. And, and that's, you can sort of see traces of it a little bit because it sort of outlines the golf course. So it was much more than a golf course. And plus it was this idea to build all these houses, which they eventually did. And so if you go there now, which you have recently, was it your first time when you did it for the book?
That was my first and only.
Yeah.
And what's so crazy is, you know, and in the back of the book, I rate it as one of the top values. And all the other courses are like in the $20 to $40 range. And Pasatiempo is what, $250 to $300, somewhere in there. And I still say it's a value because you get to play a Mackenzie, of course, where Marion Hollins lived and that she created. You know, so much history. And of course, it's that good. I mean, it's still a steal at that number, you know, which is a dear price, but you know, completely worth it. Such a special place. And your story of going through it and playing it. It's really fun. I think that there's one story too about, you know, when you talk about Mackenzie and Hollins and her influence on Augusta. I don't know if it's a true story or not, but in my research, so I wrote it anyway because it's just what you do because it was a good story that she was sent, Mackenzie sent her down to Augusta without him. And when she showed up, there was, you know, whether it was Clifford Roberts or somebody, you know, Mr. Jones, was sort of like, who's this, you know, who's this woman that you're sending to Augusta, you know, to lay out our golf course or to discuss our golf course? And Mackenzie wrote a letter basically saying that I trust her, you know, she is me. You know, that's how close they were. And then after that, it was like, yeah, the doors were all open to her at Augusta. But, you know, Mackenzie sticking up for her like that, I thought was always a sweet story.
And the day that Pasatiempo opened, the opening day, they have the original scorecard in the glass case as you walk into the little restaurant-y place.
Yeah.
And so I was studying it, and I think she, Glenna, so it was her, Bobby Jones, Marion Hollins, Bobby Jones, Mackenzie, and Glenna Collett, who was by then, I think Glenna Collett Vare, she'd married a Mr. Vare. And I think Jones did really well. I think he did the best of the four, and then Glenna, and then I guess Alistair was still trying to get his game, improve his game.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marion shot, I think like a 94. And I like to think, and I said this in the story, she was really, you know, she ran the place and she was really distracted probably because it was the opening day.
Totally. How could you not be? She's the host.
She's the host.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's like when you've got a big outing or something and you have to go play and then everyone's like, would you shoot? And then you have to lie. It's awkward. So I totally have sympathy for her there. There's so much. So the story is packed with history. But it's also, as we mentioned, a fun day of golf with you, Katie. And I want to talk a little bit about your golf, if that's all right.
Oh, God, my golf.
Come on. You started earlier in this interview.
Yeah.
No. Well, you told us how much golf for so long was a game you abhorred.
Oh, my gosh.
Tell us, give us the why.
Don't get me started.
Tell us. Well, now that you're a convert, I would like to sort of follow that progression. That's quite interesting because I think a lot of people can relate, probably none that listen to this podcast, but maybe by chance, there is a hater of golf.
There must be a spouse out there who's listening.
Who's listening and saying that stupid game. What were the things that bugged you the most?
I think
as golfers, we should be aware of this stuff.
Okay, so I grew up playing tennis. And my late husband and I grew up playing tennis in Western Massachusetts. We grew up together. And he never mentioned golf that I remember. I mean, to him, it was just kind of a non-issue. I don't think he felt one way or another about it.
Golf agnostic.
Or just thought, is that even a sport? You know? And so... Ouch. I know, right? Well, that kind of rubbed off on me, I think, just because we were such tennis fanatics. And then my first job, I remember this, out of journalism school, was at the North Lake Tahoe Bonanza, which I know were very oddly named newspaper. And I wrote a story about this controversy where there was this golf course and it was going to be turned into an RV park. And I remember thinking, oh, bring on the RV park. But these days I think, oh my gosh, if only I had started playing golf when I was at the North Lake Tahoe Bonanza, I would
be a golf course there instead of that RV park that you helped push through, Katie.
But let me tell you the best, influence. The worst story of starting this game. So I start this game. I tell my husband, I meet this guy, we were set up on a blind date, and I hadn't done much dating. And so, I was a single mom of a
life. Sure.
Yeah. Yep. And so, meet this guy, we go out, he starts talking about golf.
And you're like, you're done.
Where's the exit?
Right.
Like, really?
Yeah.
And so,
even as a golfer, I think that's a foul ball. Don't.
But you haven't
on a
met
first
him.
Date. You can't.
Oh, he's just such a straight shooter and just so endearingly kind of unfiltered. Well,
second
that way.
Date. All right.
So anyway, so he had been dating around a lot, and he even had a spreadsheet where he with all the names of all the I know he had
what.
He had, dated 32 women before he met me. And he has never shown me the spreadsheet, but I'm guessing that there was a column that was like golf Y/N.
Oh my God. Wait, all right. We should have just talked about this the whole time.
The spreadsheet.
The dating. At what point did he tell you that the spreadsheet existed?
I think pretty early. Yeah.
And so you would, and he told you the number that you were number 30, you were number 32.
I knew in sequence where I was, but I didn't know how I ranked in any other way. And I don't think he
on the Burger Dog scale. Did he use the Burger Dog scale?
To be fair, I don't think there was a Burger Dog scale, but there, and he never told me, and he's never shown it to me. And it's very, very funny. Anyway, but one of the women was this really successful, one of those Silicon Valley successful people who was like employee number 5 at someplace like Google.
Right.
And so she got advice to go golfing with him. And I thought, well, okay. Mm-hmm. And she did. I mean, she had never golfed, but she suggested that they go out on the range together. So I thought, okay, so we've been married a few years. And I finally realized, you know, if I want to spend more time with this guy, my two-trick pony husband, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to play golf. So,
yeah. And make sure you stay up there in the rankings as
well. Yeah, right.
You know,
well, I didn't, you know, I was married.
Especially as a wife, right.
So where was I going to go? I didn't want to get fired. So,
right, so, exactly.
So, oh my God, it's so hard, especially when you're older and you're trying to figure this thing out.
Yes, and it's a hard game.
He sent me to golf camp and that was a disaster.
Oh, cool. Where'd you go?
Someplace in Florida. I've blocked that whole thing out. It was just such an awful, awful thing. And then he took me, his parents live in Boca. So he took me on the course there, one of the courses there. And I didn't even know how to hold it, Tom, this thing, this golf club. And I'm kind of going, you know, total snail's pace and futzing, and I'm not golf ready or ready golf, whatever it is you're supposed to be. I'm like trying to get my glove on, and I'm like messing with the tee, and I put the ball on the tee and it kept falling off. And he's trying to explain to me, no, you're holding the ball and the tee at the same time and you're jamming it into the ground. I said, that sounds really awkward. I don't think I can do that. And before I know it, the golf police are after us, right?
Oh, no.
And this is maybe the biggest fight we've ever had. So the golf police stop us and they, you know, come up to us and they say, you're holding up like pretty much 20 people back there. And instead of defending me, my husband says, oh, well, she's a beginner and she doesn't know what she, rather than, oh, you know, I'm so sorry. She's, you know, I'm really just trying to bring her. And then he dresses me down and I'm like, you gotta be kidding. So we get back to my in-laws and I'm just, steam was coming out of my ears. And I don't know why I stuck with it. I think it was because of then I discovered our course here in, you know, our little town in New Hampshire. And I fell in love.
I'm shocked that you stuck. Yeah, that's amazing to go from that introduction where I would have quit too. And then, so it must be a pretty special little golf course that you have there.
Well, but can we at some point talk about
why this pro?
Can we talk about why women, like why more women don't play?
Yes.
Do you have any theories?
Okay. So, theories? Well, I mean, just going off my own personal experience, like some of those things that you just mentioned, right? Like putting a golf ball on a tee, like seems to me as simple as breathing, right? My wife plays a little bit and that's still like a thing, like, you know, to show her that, you know, put the ball in your hand, put the tee next to it, use the ball to drive the tee into the ground, then get it to the right height. So having to like start, and there was like a lot of frustration. Our first rounds of golf were much like the ones you described, now if we do go out and play, it's like, okay, you can't just get lost in your round. You've got to pay attention to me. I need your help. Right. And I've got to decide that, okay, I'm out playing golf with my wife. I don't care what I shoot. This round's not about me, which is hard to do because I think I'm like your husband. Like I'm into it. Right. I grind. Like I love my golf. And it almost seems to be more in our culture that women don't play as much, because if you go to Scotland or Ireland, the women's golf societies are probably more active than the men's, which is one of the great things about golf over there. So what's going on with the American woman that she's
into golf? I think, okay, my cynical...
You're writing a book about this, so tell me.
My cynical theory, because there are a lot of golf courses, I don't know if you know this about the history of women in golf, that were started by women. There's a famous story of a golf course in New Jersey. I'm going to say Morris Township. I forget. So don't quote me, although we're on a podcast. And the women started it and the men took it over. Like the women made the mistake of letting the men onto the board. And before they knew it, the men had taken over.
Always a mistake.
Always a mistake. Because I think the men figured out that there was this beautiful game. It's quiet and they can just escape and just be doing it,
yeah,
without their wives. I mean, that sounds so cynical just saying it.
No, I think it's totally realistic. Sadly, and Marion Holland started a women's golf course out on the West Coast.
On the East Coast, on Long Island. That, you know, what I want to do, one of my essays, I want to go to all these courses that women started and like look for the, like, are there any traces of these women who started these golf courses?
That would be fantastic. And then find the dude they let in, the guy who bullied his way in and ruined it.
Okay. Can I say one more thing about, so men in golf versus women in golf? I mean, there's so, we could talk forever about this, but yeah. We, at our little club here in New Hampshire, we have a weekly clinic. And the women, every Wednesday morning, and the women are, you know, we show up, there are a lot of us, and we show up and we do the clinic. And what I've heard, unsubstantiated, is that there is no clinic for men, a similar analogous clinic for men, because men don't like to like publicly display their weaknesses as players, or as to, so that's another theory.
I wouldn't know anything about that. I don't like to talk about my weaknesses. You're right. You're spot on. There aren't, at my club is the same thing. They have the women's clinic, Wednesdays and Saturdays. And what's annoying, annoys my wife, who, when she is open to the idea of learning golf, the women's clinic happens to be on Wednesday morning, Thursday morning.
Oh, assuming women don't work.
No one has a job. Yeah. Right. So that's a whole other, that's a different podcast, but so that's another thing that annoys her about golf, this assumption that she sits around at home all day eating bonbons, and it's like, oh, maybe I'll play golf today. So that doesn't work. But yeah, you're right, we don't have them, but there's no male equivalent, because not that men don't take lessons, men, you know, like I go take private lessons, like I go work with a golf pro on my own. I don't want to be in a group setting, mm-hmm. not being awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's so. That's interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But what can we do in golf? Do you
think? Well, what we can do. Here's
more women
what we,
to be playing.
Here's what we can do. We can have more female journalists writing about it from a perspective like mine.
Yes.
You know, I'm really not good, but it is a beautiful game, and. But it's also make it funny and make it feel accessible. And also these Hollins tees, we haven't talked about the misnamed Hollins tees.
That offended me. And then I was glad that your playing partner, like my first read, I was like, they put the Hollins tees in the wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, mm-hmm. because you were playing the Hollins tees and they were very, very forward.
They were so forward. I was halfway up the fairway.
And that is so ridiculous. It's like, oh, well, let's just put the woman's name on those. When she was a bomber, those should have been the back tees, should be called the Hollins tees.
Okay, so now that we've established that they shouldn't have been called the Hollins tees, what Positampo has done, which is pretty great, is that they have it's a really, you know, you get your own scorecard, which I think is funny, a separate scorecard. and they are really far forward. I mean, it's like the family tees that you see.
Yeah.
But you really feel like you're doing it, and you're doing it in a way that works for you. Like when I played Pebble and we had this great caddy, I've played there twice now. And I asked for the same caddy the next year, which was just this past May. Loved this guy, Gabriel, what a wonderful guy. And he would
Sounds
suggest,
like an angel.
I know, total angel. And he would suggest that I take my tea. My little tee and start like give myself an advantage like at the edge of the fairway, because we'd just look at the carry and we'd know there was no way I could do it from the box, even from the forward tees. And we didn't want any golf police at Pebble. Believe me, you don't want the golf police at Pebble coming after you.
You haven't been playing that long, but you have felt the scourge of the golf police. It is, and that for golfers at all levels, fear the golf police. That
is that right? I did too.
I swear. Really? Seeing that Ranger's cart out there, I don't like it. I don't like it at all. I don't want them anywhere near me. Especially as they start to approach, you know, that's one of the more unpleasant feelings you can have on a golf course.
Or if they just kind of buzz you, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
They, yeah.
Very passive aggressive, like. You know, just like, I see you. I see what you're doing. I see. But that's great. You had a great, Gabriel is a great caddy, because we should be playing from tees that allow us to enjoy the golf course, enjoy the golf hole, you know, and sort of maybe have an approach that's like, approximating what a golfer, you know, the architect would want you to have into the hole, mm-hmm. rather than taking five shots to get there, you know, mm-hmm. put yourself in a spot where you can feel like you're playing the golf hole. Mm-hmm. And I also appreciate, you know, that we just stop calling them, that we have degendered mm-hmm. golf tees for the most part. Mm-hmm. That, you know, just have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tee box or forward, middle, back, you know, whatever. You know, there's a lot of ego associated with what tee you're playing from, mm-hmm. especially for dudes. So play from the right tee. Take a lesson from our friend Katie, who I just think it's so great. How does your husband feel about your golf conversion?
Oh, he loves it, but he's also still, he's just, you know, he'll watch me miss. I'll duff and I'll shank. Actually, he says I'm not good enough to shank.
It is a good player's miss, Katie. I'm not going to lie to you.
He'll still, you know, tell me what I did wrong. You're jerking, you're swaying, you're bobbing, and instead of telling me what, you know, I should be doing. And so we kind of still get into these things. And then a friend of mine here in New Hampshire, she's pretty new to the game too. And she was so excited. And she texted me and she said, I shot a 54. This is a 9-hole course. So she shot a 54, which I said, oh my God, that's amazing. And I said, honey, Sue shot a 54. And he just looked at me. He said, you will never shoot a 54.
Oh my God. No, he didn't.
Yes, he did.
Dude.
I know. But he means well.
Better
he just
thinks spreadsheet.
He just said, well, with your backswing, you're never going to get there. So then, of course, I went to Dave.
Dave believes you can do shoot 54.
Dave totally.
Totally. How do you feel? It's just really interesting. I don't often have the chance to have a frank conversation about golf and gender. And there's just a lot to unpack there. So certainly that initial feeling that you had about the game. I mean, some of it, you know, you play with an RBG golf ball.
And when I'm not playing with my Emily Dickinson ball.
Okay, right.
And the quote on that one is, I dwell in possibility.
Oh, I love that. That's fantastic. That your other ball having the RBG quote, women belong where decisions are made. So now, how do you reconcile? Do you have any issues? Or I imagine you did, and maybe you still do, about sort of the gender lines that still exist in golf. I think they're fading away at places. Pine Valley now has women will have women members. Women members at Augusta.
So women, they don't have to move anymore. You know how they have to move if their husband dies and they live there, right?
Apparently, right. So things there's golf changes very slowly. There are some things changing, but there's some places that they're not. Mm-hmm. So as a lover of golf, are you able to sort of just appreciate the game and look past that nonsense? Honestly, you're writing about golf and you're coming on this podcast you're becoming a voice within golf too, which is pretty damn cool, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also I think the fact that I absolutely adore the game.
Yes.
I think it goes a long way toward, giving my journalistic voice credibility, because I've done a lot of sports in the past, and I used to think golf was that a sport. I didn't even get it, and mm-hmm. It's a beautiful game. And just let me just say that. So the U.S. Women's Open was at the Olympic Club this past year. And my husband, who is completely not into women's golf, he says it's professional golf. He says it's boring and predictable because they hit the ball just straight and, you know, they don't.
They're too awesome. They never, ever hit it into the rough or in bunkers.
Well, they do. So cool to watch, in fact, actually. So, but then we went, he really wanted to go to the U.S. Women's Open. So we did. And he loved it. Absolutely. Cool. And then we had to leave or something. I forget what it was, but we ended up, then he wanted to watch it, the ending on TV. Oh, because they did a playoff and they had to, and we couldn't then pick up and go with the crowd each time they were going back to the 17th hole on the 18th. And so he wanted to see what they did on those other holes. I thought it was just wonderful that he loved it so much.
That's so cool. And, like, you know, his conversion, your conversion to golf, and then you're converting him to women's golf. Like, what a nice...
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but
he, well, you took him to the, you got him to go.
But then I have to tell you, I was a walking scorer the next weekend, because then they played at Lake Merced, an LPGA tournament, and mm-hmm. walking with those women. Oh my gosh, Tom, that is a whole journey, journalistic, beautiful.
You were right there. Yeah.
Yeah. It was amazing. And this one, and they're not that predictable. They would hit the one, you know, 280 runs parallel to Lake Merced. Mm-hmm. And so whenever I play there, I worry I'm going to get like hit by a car. And one of them actually hit it onto the freeway. She overshot the green. She was coming out of a bunker, and it was actually pretty funny. Yeah. So, but that is another aspect of the game, watching the women play. It's a thing of great beauty. And I love asking men who are watching women play, you know, what they think. And they say, I only watch women's golf because they learn so much more. Isn't that interesting?
It is. And I was about to say that if you want to watch golf, yeah, as a spectator, women's golf is so wonderful to watch. One, for the skill level, obviously. Two, a lot of, I like the personalities on, you know, on the tour right now. I think there are interesting storylines. They're all much more likable than some of the men. And
is that right? Are they?
I personally think so. Mm-hmm. There are just a lot of golfers that, I don't know, maybe we know too much about. But in any event, but from an instruction point of view or a golf swing point of view, I get nothing out of watching Bryson DeChambeau swing the club. I get nothing out of watching Rory McIlroy swing the club because I'm not physically capable. Now, I can't swing like Nelly Korda either, but I can look at her tempo. So if I was going to watch a player swing, or if I was out of whack, I would watch her swing over and over for tempo and balance. Mm. And so that to me, and also, you know, distance wise and things, my game more resembles that of, you know, elite amateur women, elite female golfers, much more than it does the pros on tour, on the men's tour. So yeah, you're spot on about that. I know you're working on these essays for a collection. I hope we get to see some of them in the Golfer's Journal at some point.
Thank you. I hope so too. I'll talk to Travis about it.
We'll get it sorted. Absolutely. You're welcome back anytime. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thanks, Tom. It was really great.